Hi, my name's Debbie, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey,
hi, everybody. And by the grace of my higher power that I call God, the fellowship of AA, and the wonderful program of AA, I haven't had a drink since April 1st, 1990. And I'm truly grateful for that. Truly grateful. I share with my eyes closed. And the reason I do that is I'm easily distracted by any moving object and I will forget what I'm saying. So I share with my eyes closed and I speak with my eyes closed. So if you can make all the faces you want or do anything else, it doesn't matter. I may open my eyes, everybody will be gone. I don't know. I have no idea until I open them again. My first meeting I came to for me. Now I went to a lot of meetings for people that I care about that felt like they needed to quit drinking. But the first meeting I went for me was sometime in 1988. And I went to this meeting. In hindsight, I really see it. It must have been a birthday meeting because I went in this hangover state, and I sat in the back of the room, and it was almost like I felt like a party crasher. You know, they had people coming up in front, and people were yelling, "Yay, Jan! Yay!" You know, whatever. And that you know, the place I was in at that time was so isolated, and I felt so empty that, well, first of all, they were just far too happy for me. And secondly, I just didn't feel like I fit. I didn't feel like I belonged. And so I left, and it took them almost another 2 years for me to make it back. Let me also say before I get started that if anything I share today is not in the big book, then it is just my experience or how that's come about for me. If you can't find it in the big book, and it doesn't mean you have to do it that way, it doesn't mean my way's right or my way's wrong, it's just my experience, that's it. Normally what I share when I get behind a podium, and I think one of the reasons I'm a little more nervous this time, normally what I share is about the steps. And then I pepper in some of my experience when I was an active alcoholic in there. And recently I've been working with several women that have slipped, have relapsed, or new to the program. And I've been talking to some people also, and they've been talking about qualifying, And between those two, I've really gone back and started looking about my drink when I was drinking, and also my first days in sobriety, when I first came into recovery, into the program of AA. And so I guess that's kind of what I want to share about today, and we'll just see how much time there is. And it's funny, I was talking with Ellen yesterday, and she said she had a spotter in the front that would tell her when she was halfway through so she could get sober, and then that would tell her, when time was up, quit time. And I said, well, when you have your eyes closed, it's kind of hard to have a spotter. I'm going to have somebody tap their feet or something. But I'm going to try. I don't know how long I have. I'm going to try to do this anyway. I heard Doc share in a meeting recently, and he said, good, bad, and ugly. And when he said that, I thought, that was my drinking. There was the good, there was the bad, and there was the ugly. And when it was good, it was really good. I mean, I had fun drinking. When it was good, it was really good. Whether I was buying bootleg whiskey from some people in the hills of Alabama, or if I was hitchhiking with a bunch of people in California drinking Boone's Farm. It was fun. I had lived a very structured life growing up, and I was coming out, and I was going to have fun. And nothing was going to stop. I was just going to have a good time. First job I took, well, one of the first jobs I took, because I started working right away, but one of the first jobs I took was with a restaurant company, and we would travel and put in an ad and hire people and train them and order the uniforms and set it up and get the restaurant going, then we'd go to another town and do it again. And I worked the middle shift. I would come in right before lunch, and I'd leave after the dinner finished down, as did the back of the house staff. And we would all go out and drink. And this was a perfect job for me. My room was paid for. My food was paid for. The clothes I wore was a opening crew outfit, uniform. And it was just perfect for me. And I had a blast. I built relationships with people on different opening crews. We would drink. We would just have a great time. That for me. But, eventually, as was always the case, I would start disappointing people. Their expectations and my wants would collide. And then I start getting that disapproving look. And that, you know, and it's not work, because I had a very strong work ethic. That was something that was real important to me. And that's one of the reasons I think that financial fear of insecurity never really bothered me, was because I heard a guy share in a meeting one time, he said, if money is your problem, you don't have a problem. And I could understand that, because I'd just get a second job. I would just work harder. I would just move up. There was, you know, that was not something that really was a problem for me. But anyway, but having any kind of principles or having any kind of consistency of being a friend or knowing how to develop relationships or people could count on me or whatever else, I didn't know how to do that. I had no idea how to do that. And so, you know, I don't think I even knew about fight or flight or if I knew about geographical cures or any of that stuff. My motto at that time was, life's too short to be unhappy, I'm out of here. And so when anybody started getting a little bit upset, started giving me a hard time, the, you know, he got too hot in the kitchen, whatever, I would get my last paycheck and throw what few belongings I had in the trunk and my clothes in the back seat and I'd leave. And that's what I did with them. No 2-week notice, no goodbye, no, and just picked up my paycheck and I was out of there. And my family was living in Memphis at the time. And so I went to Memphis and I got a job there. And my sister was working in a bar. And she would make more in 4 nights than I made in 2 weeks. And so my fast mind said, you're in the wrong business. And so I went to work in the bar. And again, I just loved it. You know, it was perfect for me. I worked as a waitress, then I worked as a bartender, then I worked as a head bartender, then I became bar manager. And I had fun. We did Memphis, it was in Memphis. We did Memphis in May for Budweiser, and we just, I mean, it, you know, jazz, Beale Street, ribs, you know, rendezvous, just, it was fun. I partied, and that's what I wanted to do. At my house, I would throw parties, theme parties, come on over, you know, we're having Mexican dinner. I'd make homemade sangria and have margaritas. And it was fun. That's what I, now I'm saying it's fun, but there was problems. I mean, I threw up in back seats and you got pulled over by the cops and back then, you know, this is in the 70s. Back then, they just followed you home. You didn't get DUIs or DW. They just wanted to make sure you got home without killing yourself or anybody in the process. And I would go through friends. You know, I was always with people, but it was never the same people for very long, you know. But I had fun. You know, it was fun. And about that time, I was diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis. Now, I was never, and I know this is AA, but I was never a drug user. I had tried marijuana for like 1.5 years, and I didn't like what it did to me. I never knew if I was going to get happy or sad or what, and I didn't like it, so I quit that. And I did speed for a little while until I found myself throwing up on the side of the street, and I said, I'll never do this again if I can get over this. And I did do it again, you know, but I just didn't like chewing my teeth out and jumping out of my skin, so I didn't do that a lot. And as a bartender, people would give me lines of Coke. And I would give them away, because favors get favors, and so I'd give them away to people. But I got rheumatoid arthritis, and so they started giving me pain pills, lots and lots of pain pills. And I was given 100 muscle relaxers, 100 Darvon, and 25 Percocets a month for 5 years. And I would give away most of the muscle relaxers. I just really didn't care for those. And I would share my Percocets with most people. I love my Darvons. I mean, I 3 a day, you know, keeps Daddy happy. And so I would do those. And they also chase away hangovers, you know. So I love those things. And so I also got married for the first time in there. And with my rheumatoid arthritis, I couldn't work anymore behind the bar in a fast-paced bar. And so I started working more day shifts. And I got married in there the first time. And he had a different idea about what a wife should be than I had. You know, he thought wives came home when they got off work. And I thought wives continued to do whatever they wanted to do when they got off work, you know. And he happened to work at nights. He was in med school, and he worked at nights in a sleep lab. And so he didn't get home till 4 or 5 in the morning. So a lot of times it really wasn't a big debate, you know, because he wasn't there to know. But a couple of times I overshot the mark, and he wasn't real happy about that, you know. And so we got married, and we lived together probably about 6 months the first time we split up. And off and on, we were together and not together and together and not together. And for about a year and a half in the marriage end. And when the marriage ended, the last time, I remember I had an apartment, and I got off my work, and I came home, and I sat in a rocking chair, and I just sat there and drank, and sat there and drank. And I don't know if I did that for a few days, a few weeks, or what, but one day it occurred to me, you can sit here every day like this till you die, and no one will care, or you can do something about this. And so I thought, I know what I'll do. I'll go to Colorado. I had a friend who opened a bar in Colorado, and he told me if I ever wanted a job, I had one with him. So I called him up, and he said, sure, come on. And so I was going to move to Colorado. And about the time my sister came to me, and she said her and her husband were moving to Georgia, to Atlanta. He wanted to go to Georgia Tech. And if I wanted to put my stuff on the back of the truck, we could move there and share rent. And we could, you know. And so I called one of the clubs I had worked for in Memphis. And sure enough, they were opening a place here in Atlanta. And they said I was hired. And so I did. And I moved to Atlanta instead. That was in 79. And I went to work here, and I guess that's where my drinking started really getting into the bad. You know, I would get up and have oatmeal with amaretto. I would have coffee and Kahlua. I'd go out for lunch, and I would drink. I would go to happy hour and drink. When I was behind the bar, I'd drink. Then we'd go to after hours and drink. Now, I didn't do that every day, but I did most of it many days. And I remember after going to an after-hour club, I was driving home, because we'd all go to breakfast after that, and I was driving home after having breakfast, and people were driving to work, and I thought, you poor saps. You're going to work, and I'm going home and going to bed. I feel so sorry for you, you know. And little did I know, you know, little did I care, really, at that point. And like I said, I didn't do a lot of, I really didn't do a lot of drugs. When I split up with David, I tried a few bootleg things and in there and stuff. But again, it just wasn't something for me. Well, as my drinking progressed and my Darvons progressed and my work progressed, I found it harder and harder to get up in the morning. So I would started doing a little in the morning just to get going. And then I'd do a little more at night so I could drink more. And after a while, it got so that this was kind of something I enjoyed. And so I thought, well, again, my financial mind kicked in. You know, if I sold some, I could actually use for free. And so we had a dealer that really gave us a good price on some. And so little did I know at the time about the first rule of drug use, don't get high from your own supply. And little did I know that the more you have, the more you do. But anyway, I never sold any. And I used to keep them in a cylinder, in a flashlight, in an abandoned doghouse that was in my backyard. Because I didn't want them in the house, you know. I just didn't want them in the house. And so, not thinking what was, someone would question, what's a flashlight doing in the doghouse? You know, but anyway, I'm going to speed my drunk along a little bit. We ended up moving to, what I had to come to terms with in sobriety about my drug use was that given sufficient reason, I could quit doing drugs. Given for sufficient reason, or if things got too difficult, I could quit doing drugs. I couldn't do that with alcohol. And I know today that I am an alcoholic who's powerless, that when I start drinking, I am powerless over drugs or anything else. And I know that if I ever tried a drug, it would take me back to alcohol. I mean, I know that as well. But anyway, we moved to New York, and we got married in New York. We got married in one of the leading hotels of the world there. We did not make a lot of money in New York, but we had privy to a lot of nice things. you know, we could take a limo to the Tony, but we couldn't get a cab. We didn't have money for a cab or a hot dog on the street, you know. We could eat in the finest restaurants, but, you know, we were, you know, counting quarters to, you know, get, you know. So, but we had, like I said, and they did our wedding just beautiful. You know, they had it in the suite, and they did the cake, and they did the hors d'oeuvres, and it was just really beautiful, you know. And they gave us beautiful presents, and we could invite a limited amount of people, but, and they brought presents. I was so drunk, someone had to hold the back of my dress up for me to do the vows. I missed the whole thing. I have beautiful pictures of the reception. I have beauty, you know, but I was not there. I missed the whole thing. And from there, we moved to, we lived there until 87. From there, we moved to San Francisco. And that, in San Francisco, my husband had been trying, to get sober for a while and going through his own struggle, and I won't get in his story, but he did start going to AA in San Francisco, and I would go with him. I'm a supportive wife. I would go with him. And it was real entertaining listening to those people, you know. And I don't remember a lot, but they must have been speaker meetings. And I remember people telling the story and me laughing and stuff, you know. And good thing they got this thing for you guys, because this is a good place for you to go, you know. And and so as he decided to go to AA, I thought I needed to start hiding my, you know, I didn't want him to start drinking. He needed AA. So I started hiding my drinking from him. And so when he wasn't home, I would drink. And I always thought that I started drinking in the morning, you know, later in my story. But actually, you know, if you do after hours club and you go to brunch, there's very few hours in there anyway, you know. So morning drinking was a just natural logic of flow of things, you know. And so I would, whenever he wasn't there, I would drink. And from there we moved to San Diego, where I went to the aforementioned meeting, because I was really, you know, drinking was just really, I was drinking when I didn't want to drink. I was drinking, you know, Michael's not home, I better drink now, I won't get a chance later on, you know. And I was just, and I was hiding my drinking, and I was all the other stuff that comes with that. And you know, he would go to a 7 o'clock meeting, and when he would go, I would start drinking. And I found I was on the phone with people, and I grew up in L.A. I grew up in the Long Beach area, and I had friends coming down to see me, and they drank. And we would go to a bar, and I'd start getting rowdy with the bartender, you know. And I found myself coming out of blackouts, arguing with cashiers, you know. And I mean, I didn't know they were blackouts at the time. I mean, I was just all of a sudden, I just didn't know what I was arguing about, and I'd walk away, you know. And you know, because I didn't believe. It took me a long time in AA to understand that I had blackouts. I had spaces I didn't remember. That's what I thought they were, spaces that I didn't remember. I thought blackouts meant passed out, and I didn't think I passed out either. But anyway, from San Diego, Michael accepted a job in Puerto Rico, and we went to Puerto Rico. And for the first few months there, until our furniture arrived, we lived in the hotel. And I would venture out to the liquor store, or to the grocery store. They sold liquor in the grocery store. To the grocery store and bring the liquor back. My grocery bills were real high, you know, because of the fact that I would try to hide my booze in the grocery store bill, you know. And I would bring it back. But inevitably, I would always run out. I would never have enough. And we had a mini bar there. Now, you can't call up room service and order liquor when you're trying to hide your drinking. So we had a mini bar there. And so I would, and they also have seals that go across those little mini, those little bottles. And the hotel has a seal as well, besides the liquor seal. And so those mini bar attendants have sharp eyes. They know when those things have been broken. So I would have to peel it off and try and fill it back up with water, then go buy another one, put it back on. And it was just exhausting. It was just exhausting hiding this drinking. Also, getting rid of bottles. You know, you can't leave them in the trash can in the room. You can't dump them beside the pool in the garbage. They got security. They'll tell on you. Those guys cannot keep a secret. You can't take that chance. So getting rid of bottles is just just a chore. And so The only thing harder is trying to get pills back into a bottle, and I'll explain that in a few minutes. But anyway, we moved across the street, and we rented a place across the street from the hotel and moved in after Hurricane Hugo went through and all the other stuff happened, and the stuff was arriving, and I thought, you know, theme party again. Let's have a theme party. The stuff's moving in today. Let me go get a six-pack of beer. And while they're moving the stuff, I'll have a beer and check in the stuff. And I finished the beer before they ever even arrived, you know. So I had to leave and go get something. I was fear they would come and bring the booze back and get started drinking. And it's amazing. They probably could have delivered somebody else's furniture and I wouldn't have known it, you know. And so my drinking just escalated from there. And so I dropped down to 93 pounds. I was sick all the time. I couldn't make it from the bed to the couch. I was all, like I said, I was sick all the time. Mike would bring doctors over from the hotel. They had a doctor on staff, or on stipend, I guess, actually, what it was. And they'd bring him over. And like I said, I was just sick all the time. And I had tried drinking every other day. I was a daily morning drinker. I mean, I'd hide the stuff at the bottom, you know, and all the stuff. You know, I hid my booze one time in one of those squeeze salad dressing bottles, you know, and it would have pickles and pimentos and oil around the side of the glass. But a girl's got to do what a girl's got to do, you know, to drink. And so, cheers. And so. Anyway, at this point it wasn't funny anymore. I was afraid to leave the house without drinking. I was afraid to leave the house once I started drinking. I just didn't know what would happen. I would call people, even from Porter, you know, and I just no idea. And I was sick and tired. I mean, I was just at, and this was December 22nd, 1989. And so I went to my first AA meeting. And I knew it had worked for my husband. And I thought, you know, if I can go there and build up my immune system, get some time away from that last drink, I'll be able to control my drinking again, and everything will be fine. So I'll just go there for a while until I start feeling better, and then I'll be okay. So I went to my first AA meeting, and the girl that led the meeting, I don't remember what they talked about, but she kept saying she had 90 days. I have 90 days. I can chair meetings. I have 90 days. And I was listening to her, and I thought, 90 days. Well, that's a little extreme, isn't it? I don't want 90 days. I don't want 90 days from my last drink, you know. I just want a little time from my last drink. And ladies after the meeting came up, and they gave me their phone number, and they gave me a lot of good information. I don't know if I got it then or if I got it later. But they gave me phone numbers. They told me to keep hard candy on me. They said, phones, they weren't cell phones, at least not there. It was dime for the phone. Keep a dime on me to make a call. If I had to go any place that had alcohol, take someone with me. If I couldn't take someone with me, make sure I parked so I could get my car out or had taxi money on me so I could get home. I mean, they gave me a lot of good instructions when I first came in. Things you'll find in Living Sober, probably, I know you can today. But they gave me a lot of good information. I just kept coming back. I would white knuckle it. The meetings they had in Puerto Rico, it was the only English speaking meeting in San Juan. It's called the Serenity Club. I would white knuckle. It was noon, 5:30, and 8, I believe. Those were the times. But I know it was noon because that's when I went to. And I would just white, because I was a morning drinker, I'd just white knuckle it to that noon meeting. And then after the meeting, I'd be okay. And there's a lot of times I'd tell myself, just go to you can have a drink after the noon meeting. Just get to the noon meeting. You can have a drink after the noon meeting. Just get to the noon meeting. And that's what I did for a week. Anyway, for a while. And I would stay after the meeting. And the room was set up where there were chairs like this. And then there was four tables. And people smoked. We all smoked back then. And people would lay their heads against the side of the wall. And they'd have these black spots all the way around the room from people putting their heads up. And so I would stay after meetings. And not every day, but paint the black spots off the wall. And we had a guy that did the kitchen, and I'd have a sandwich, and I would talk to him, and they gave me that little book on acceptance, and they gave me the little book on the absolutes, and they gave me a copy of How It Works, and all this other stuff. And I asked this lady to be my sponsor. And a bunch of ladies went to lunch after our noon meeting, and they invited me along, and I went, and I was in the elevator alone, just she and I, and I said, will you be my sponsor? She goes, I am your sponsor. And I went, good. You know, and so we started working together. Well, actually, she started working with me. I really didn't do anything. And she would say, go home and read this in the big book, and I would put it in my car, and then I'd come back and see her next week, and she'd say, did you read it? I said, yeah. I became one of those bobbleheads, And she'd say, well, what did you get out of it? And I'd say, well, what did you get out of it? And she'd tell me, and I'd say, yeah, that's what I got out of it, too. You know. But one thing she did do is she gave me questions. And she gave me anyone who works with me today knows I give them questions. I give them lots and lots of questions. Well, she only gave me a couple questions. And the question was, say two times that you said you weren't going to get drunk but did. Tell me two times you were going to have just one for the road and got drunk. Tell me a time you were going to be there for somebody and you couldn't be, or you were drunk when you showed up. And so I started writing those things out, and I'd take them to her. And I started recognizing some of the ways alcohol had been in my life. And I had a lot of guilt, just so much guilt and shame around my drinking and using. You know, my drinking was a lot worse in the middle of it than it was at the end, because I was like that tornado going through the lives of people. I didn't care, you know, what I wanted, when I wanted, where I wanted. That was definitely true for me. And I had let down people, relatives, friends, strangers, everybody. You know, I mean, I just really, and I just had no control. I just really, selfish self-centeredness, but I didn't see it as selfish self-centeredness. I thought I cared for everybody. I was a sensitive soul that was constantly the victim of other people, you know. I could not, and today I even find today that I struggle the hardest with people who think they're people pleasers, because getting them past that to see how alcohol really, the selfish self-centeredness manifests itself is really cunning, baffling, and powerful. It really is, because I struggled with that. Anyway, my mother-in-law during that time came to live with us, and she was handicapped. She had to use a walker to get around. And here I have these feelings coming up, and I've shared this before, but you know, they said, come back, you feel better, come back, you feel better. And I do. I feel anger better, resentment better, jealousy better, all those things better. And I was, you know, I hear my feelings were screaming. I didn't even know what to call them. I'm trying to stay sober. And she came to live with us. And I was afraid to go to meetings. What if she fell? Who was going to help her? Well, we had this guy that came to meetings, and his name was Reuben, and he's passed away since then. He's dead. He's not here anymore. Anyway, he would come to meetings, and I'd give him rides and stuff, and I told him one day, I said, Reuben, you know, I'm afraid I'll leave her. And he said, well, if she falls, she just falls. She'll have to lay there for an hour. You go to meetings. Well, you know, in my sick brain, I wasn't afraid of her falling. I was afraid of what people would think of me if she fell. I was afraid of what people would say about me if she fell. My concern was not with her. My concern was with me. And so now I had permission, so I could go to meetings. And I went to my meetings. And about that time, a girl shared in the meeting, and she said, I want to hang around with the winners. And the old-timers are the winners. Well, my sick brain, when I heard that, I played that tape over and over, she was calling me a loser. So I told everybody who would stand still long enough what I thought of her and her little remark, including my sponsor. And my sponsor told me, oh, Debbie, we're like little pressure cookers. You know, we got a lot off, a little steam. Go read 551, 552, and 553 in the big book and do it. Well, I don't know if I read 551, 552, and 53. I don't know if I even tried to do it. And I told other people, and they'd say, pray, and this too will pass, and I just struggled with that for the longest time. One day I gave people rides to meetings and home again all the time. I was taking Reuben to a meeting, and he got out, and I probably told him for the umpteenth time about her. And he said, you're right, she's a bitch. And he got out of the car, and it went away. It was gone. I didn't struggle with it anymore. Anyway, so my mother-in-law had to go in to see the doctor, and he gave her some pain pills. He gave her Darvon. And so here I am, you know, 30, 60, not 60 days sober, whatever, walking out of the prescription with these Darvons in my hand, and I snag 10 of them. And I can do that real quick. And I stick them in my, I'm a thief by nature. Honesty, dishonesty, ever how you want to look at it, it's one of my biggest character defects and something I struggle with all the time. I have to stay on the AA beam with that all the time. And so I stuck them in my pocket. Now, I don't know if they were in my pocket for a day or if they were in my pocket for 2 days or whatever. But I knew I couldn't keep them. I just knew I couldn't. So I had to get them back and not get caught. I've never had to put pills back into a bottle and not get caught. I mean, nobody's going to believe you. I'm putting them back. Oh, yeah, right. Sure you are. You know, no one's going to believe you. But anyway, I went to meetings, and Reuben came over to the house, and he said, you got to make her feel useful. You got to make her feel useful. So she needs to make her bed. She needs to clean the hall bath and let her fold clothes. So I explained to her very carefully how you had to fold the towels and the linen, because we had a real narrow linen closet. So you've got to fold them like this or they won't fit, just like this. And I folded a couple. This is how I come home, and she's got them folded real big, really big. So I called Reuben. I said, she's folded them wrong. She's not doing it right. And he said, Debbie, it doesn't matter how she folds them. If you don't like the way she does it, you need to redo it. She just folds them. You can't make any judgments about that. All this sounds pretty stupid, but all these things helped me learn as I went along how to, people don't do it the way I think they need to do it, that's really none of my business. And what I need to just worry about is how I do it. All these things had to happen. Well, I worked through right about 90 days. My first sponsor and I went through the steps very fast. And I'd done my first fifth step. Now, I know in the big book it says if you don't do the fifth, you may drink. But it also says if you hold back things about yourself, you might drink. I did it the best I could where I was at that time. And where am I at? Okay. I did the best I could at that time, and I had a slip. I came back to the rooms, and they told me, they said, I came back at the 5:30 meeting. I shared I had a slip. I went to the noon meeting. I shared I had a slip. I'm sure I went to the 8 o'clock meeting. Shared I had a slip. I went back to the noon meeting. Shared I had a slip. I went 5:30. I shared I had a slip. Reuben turned to me one day and said, enough already. Get on with recovery, you know. And he was absolutely right, you know, because I was still trying to be the victim, you know, poor me. But one thing I did recognize from that was I'm an alcoholic, and that I do what alcoholics do. If I don't have any other tools, I am going to drink and use, and that's what I'm going to do. I'm gonna end because it's almost time, isn't it? Five more minutes.
Ten more minutes.
Oh. Right after that, Rocky. I'm trying not to say any names. Right after that, my sponsor fired all of us. She had some stuff going on in her life, and so she fired all of us. Now my head understood that. You know, she's got to take care of her. Well, right before she fired all of us, Michael, my husband, told me. He said, "Don't put her on a pedestal." Don't put her on a pedestal. And I was like, if she drinks, I'll be there for her. I drank, she was there for me. If she drinks, I'll be there, because that's what us alcoholics do. Yeah. Anyway, she didn't drink. She fired all of us. And, you know, all that abandonment, all that rejection, all that inadequacy, all that feelings came up in me. I was, you know, like I said, of course you don't talk about that stuff to people. You don't tell people. I mean, she fired five of us. No one else is whining about it. So you kind of play like it doesn't matter, you know. And there was this lady that went to meetings. She had 14 years, 17 years, and I would hear her share. And she would always talk about what a louse her boss was, or a louse her partner was. Or she was real. I thought she was real, you know. And so I was going to ask her to be my sponsor. And I went to a 5:30 meeting. She wouldn't be there. And I'd call her and I'd get her machine. I didn't think I should leave on the message. Will you be my sponsor? So I wanted to ask her. And so this went on for a long time. And one day, and I will use this lady's name, Melissa. And Melissa had been a sponsor also of the lady who fired us all. Melissa and I went to lunch. And Melissa said, have you got a sponsor? And I said, well, I've really been trying to. I don't want to sound like I'm procrastinating or anything, but, you know, I'd go to her meeting, she isn't there, and I'd call her and she isn't there, and it just didn't work out. And Melissa laughed, and she said, well, you know, sometimes God allows a little procrastination for things to go the way they're supposed to go. You know, as long as you're willing, I wouldn't worry about it too much. Just, you know, you're trying. And she went to the ladies' room while she's gone, I'm thinking, I want to ask her to be my sponsor. She has a year and a half more than me. And it was the best thing I ever did. Melissa gave me, I'm not here to judge you. My first sponsor gave me the big book, and she gave me a lot of disciplines in AA. But Melissa gave me the compassion. I'm not here to judge you. And she, when I would do something, she'd say, Debbie, I can't do that. Or, and feel like a good sober woman, or stay clean and sober. Or she'd say, Debbie, I'd have to do that if I wanted to feel like a good clean woman or stay clean and sober. And she gave me the compassion. And I am so grateful for that because I was struggling so hard at the time. I did 6 through 9 with Melissa. And I'm so grateful I did. She had a wonderful experience with 8 and 9 to share with me that a lot of times I hear in the room people, you know, she did not push her beliefs on me. One of the things I'll share real quick, and this is different than what I was just talking about, but we had a function we had to go to, and I went and bought this outfit. And I had to get a really nice outfit, and I went, and I knew how much money I had to spend, so I bought a classy jacket and classy skirt and high heels and jewelry and all this stuff, and I paid for it. Well, they didn't charge me for the skirt. They didn't charge me for the skirt. You know, I didn't steal it. They didn't charge me for the skirt. And so I was thrilled about it. And so I went home, and I called, stupid me, called my sponsor. And I told her, they didn't charge me for the skirt. And she said, Debbie, I couldn't do that. I couldn't do that and feel like a good, sober woman. I couldn't live with that and feel good about myself. And tell you anymore. You know, so I called the lady up, and I went down, and I paid for the skirt. And and that's how Melissa, that's what Melissa did for me. She worked a wonderful 8 and 9, and she helped me through that. I thought I had built a relationship with God up to that point. Every time I would pray, when I was going through 8 and 9, it felt like my prayers were hitting the ceiling and bouncing back at me, and hitting the ceiling and bouncing back at me. And she said, and I met her for coffee one evening late, and she said, did you put yourself on the list? I said, no. She said, well, you need to put yourself on the list, too. And I know a lot of people are against that, including myself and others I had harmed and all that stuff. But by putting my, and I hate rushing through this because really, I really do. But by putting myself on the list, what I saw was every time I harmed you, I was harming me. Every time I did you bad, I was telling myself how lousy I was. No one can count on you. You can never be there for people. You'll never amount to anything. What's wrong with you? And so I had this, you know, and it really started holding me accountable for my actions. I was judging myself by my intentions while the world was judging me by my actions. And I really got in touch with that when I did my 8th and 9th step. You know, and I didn't know my character defects. When I did 6 and 7 with my sponsor, I borrowed hers. I didn't know what mine were. And it's been going through the steps over and over again that I've really got to start looking at this stuff. And I'm going to, this program works when I work it. I got another sponsor when we moved to, there's so much more to tell, just so much more to tell. You know, we buy in a house thinking I'm working step 3 by saying, God, if it be your will, I really like this house, but if it be your will, and then he give it to us, and then we moved, and God, why'd you give us this house? You knew we were going to move anyway, you know. And just the whole struggle of going through getting rid of my old ideas. You know, what I've learned about this program is step 2 is so important. I thought I had the first 3 steps because I had a strong base in religion, and I knew nothing about a higher power till I came in here. Michael told me one time, he heard a guy say, he said, I found God in AA and I celebrate him in Mass, and that has been true for me. I've got a relationship with a higher power in here that I would have not gotten anywhere else, and I had to get enough of me out of the way to allow that to happen. I had to get rid of a lot of old ideas, and that's what step 2 for me is about, getting rid of that prejudice and those old ideas. And I had to start believing in a God who cared enough about me, he wanted me to succeed, not someone who was judging me. And so I had to go through and work those steps over and over again to get enough of me out of the way to make that real in my life. But it is real today, and I am so grateful for that. And I'm so grateful I don't have to drink and use. And I'm so grateful today that, no, things aren't always wonderful. No, things don't. I know it's real easy to look at people with time and think, oh, yeah, your life's just perfect. You know what to do. No, I don't. But I know today I don't have to drink and use, and I know I have a higher power that's going to help me, and I know I have people in the AA that are going to help me. And that, to me, is worth more than anything else. That, to me, is priceless. You know, and I would not trade it in for anything. I also know, that said, I have a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of my spiritual condition. And I know I'm not immune from alcohol. If I want this thing today, I have to do it today. And with that, I'll close. Thanks.